Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the president chooses this outlandish, entertaining, honest, obscure outpost of the First Amendment to make some pretty important statements about racism. Did you notice? On the streaming interview program WTF, a popular podcast, Barack Obama talked about racism, alive and well in America, with WTF host Mark Maron.
The legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, discrimination in almost every institution of our lives, you know, that casts a long shadow. And that's still part of our DNA. That's passed on. We're not cured of it.
This hour, how the online world is a window on a lot of America we might prefer not to look at, as well as something that drives institutions like higher education and the changing music business. Warning, Taylor Swift music later this hour. But we begin by playing out what the president means by the DNA of racism and where it can be found replicating itself in the wake of the Charleston shootings. What the president is talking about is hardly a surprise. Instead of DNA, the president could just have easily spoken about specific groups dedicated to white supremacy that exist today, that go back more than a century, that have been active in mainstream American politics and still are. This week, The Guardian reported Earl Holt III, the leader of a white supremacist group, donated thousands of dollars to a number of current Republican presidential campaigns. Holt's group, the Pro-Segregationist Council of Conservative Citizens, apparently influenced Dylan Roth, the Charleston shooter. Joining us is Joe Crespino, author of Strom Thurmond's America and In Search of Another Country, Mississippi and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. He's also a professor of history at Emory University.
The history of white supremacist groups in American politics is deeply rooted. One of the places to begin in thinking about it is with the important role, say, that the Ku Klux Klan played in the 1920s. It started during the Reconstruction period, but it revived in the 1920s and was popular in many areas, not just in the South. It was a stronghold in Indiana. They were a force to be reckoned with in Detroit politics. And a number of high-profile politicians had ties to the Klan. Hugo Black, the liberal Supreme Court justice, had been a member in Alabama in the 1920s, as well as Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia. So, you know, there's a long history of this kind of connections between white supremacist groups and mainstream politicians.
And if we were to have a conversation about whether a member of Congress was, you know, recruited by ISIS or the mayor of Detroit had something to do with al-Qaeda, it would be such an explosive conversation, it wouldn't even last very long. But we never have this conversation about the KKK and where these kinds of groups are in relationship to American politics, but they're certainly much closer than ISIS or al-Qaeda.
Yeah, it's striking, really. And people who come from the outside, people who are not familiar with American history, I think are really shocked to see how prominent the symbols of the Confederacy remain in our public life today. I had friends visiting from Germany last week, and we went out to Stone Mountain of Georgia to see the Confederate memorials that are there. It's really remarkable how much that is a part and how much that gives a kind of sanctuary for certain extremist groups in our politics today.
And the German experience of dealing with extremism post the Nazi era is essentially to kind of cleanse society of all these messages in a very, very active way. And that's something that, for a variety of reasons, we didn't do in the United States.
No, we haven't done it. And it's striking to go to Germany and see how differently they handle their very troubled history compared to the way that we think about our own history of white supremacy in the United States. It's really a striking difference.
When Barack Obama says it's still a part of our DNA that's passed on, is he talking about some impression, some, you know, prejudice, or is he talking about, or do you hear him talking about a whole organized movement of white supremacist and white power groups that began with the beginning of the United States?
Well, it's certainly true that, you know, throughout the 18th and 19th century, white supremacy was the mainline position in American politics. To be for racial equality puts you in a vast minority in American politics. You were radicals. You were far, far outside the mainstream. And so the whole idea of it being an advocate for social equality and racial equality is a artifact of the 20th century. So it's important to remember that historically, the issues that we are dealing with, while they seem ancient, are really quite new, relatively new in the broader sweep of American history. So to say that it's in our DNA is a way of saying that it's deeply rooted in our history, and it remains close to the surface and something that this country has not fully reckoned with in our public life.
And it's not unexpected that Barack Obama would speak like an academic to say it's a part of our DNA that's passed on. Maybe a better way of describing it is that while you would have to maybe work pretty hard to find a way into a website for ISIS and Al-Qaeda, to get the message of race war in the U.S. requires almost no effort at all. A Dylan Roth could absorb this message by simply walking down the street of where he grew up.
Well, it's true, and the internet has certainly, you know, expanded the ability of groups to communicate and to form communities around some pretty toxic ideas. But it's also true, John, that these ideas, you can draw a line from where we are today back into our relatively recent and not so recent past, and see how, you know, white supremacist groups have played a role, a consistent role in our politics. You know, I talked about the Klan earlier, but, you know, that their role continued throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, where they had clear ties to the Southern Democratic Party. And then, you know, a lot of this changes in the 1960s as partisan politics begin to change. And groups that are explicitly white supremacists find common cause with other kinds of conservative groups or anti-government, and they find a kind of safe haven there, and they find a lot of, you know, sympathetic support there with various anti-government groups that are emerging. But, you know, there are groups that still exist to this day that have their roots in groups that played a larger role in mainstream politics in decades past, but that still exist today and that still spew their hatred in ways that are repugnant.
Joe Crespino is author of Strom Thurmond's America and In Search of Another Country, Mississippi and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. He's also a professor of history at Emory University. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.